I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, U.S. Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn and Sergeant Aquilino Gannell and D.C. Police Officers Daniel Hodges and Michael Fanone described in vivid, emotional, and horrifying detail what it was like to defend the Capitol and the people who worked there on January 6th when an insurrectionist mob was determined to overturn a legitimate election by staging a violent coup. 140 officers were injured that day, five later died, and two officers died by suicide. The men described hand-to-hand combat that left them with physical and emotional wounds, being afraid they would be killed by their fellow Americans, being called traitors, and for Dunn, the N-word repeatedly. They spoke to the House Select Committee charged with investigating the January 6th attack. There were tears from the officers and also from members of the committee. Here's Adam Kinzinger, one of the two Republicans on the committee, responding to the testimony.
I never expected a day to be quite as emotional for me as it has been. I've talked to a number of you and gotten to know you. I think it's important to tell you right now, though. You guys may, like, individually feel a little broken. You guys all talk about the effects you have to deal with, and, you know, you talk about the impact of that day. But you guys won. You guys held. You know, democracies are not defined by our bad days. We're defined by how we come back from bad days, how we take accountability for that. And for all the overheated rhetoric surrounding this committee, our mission is very simple. It's to find the truth, and it's to ensure accountability.
We're going to play more clips from yesterday's hearing, what we learned, what it means, and where we go from here. But first, let me introduce our two guests. Luke Broadwater is a congressional correspondent for The New York Times. He was in the room. Luke, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Barbara McQuaid. She's a professor at the University of Michigan Law School. And from 2010 to 2017, she served as U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, also co-chair of the Terrorism and National Security Subcommittee of the Attorney General's Advisory Committee in the Obama administration. And Barbara McQuaid, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks very much, Marty. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. I should have Barbara McQuaid joining us by Skype. Luke, let me begin with you. You were in that room. We were watching on our TV sets here at WHYY. What was the atmosphere? What was the mood in the room as we heard from these officers?
I would say it was a mix of both somber and emotional. When you entered the room, it was quite quiet. It's a pretty small hearing room. It's not one of the bigger hearing rooms that other committees meet in. And there was a little area for the press, and then there was a little area for staff. But mostly the room was filled up by the four officers and the committee. And, you know, it was hard to watch. Yeah. I mean, right away they played a video of the sort of horrors of January 6th, where you have the officers being assaulted, the violent threats made against them in really sort of excruciating detail. And if you're sitting in the room, it was extremely loud. The video was quite loud. And as it was playing, this is right at the beginning.
Sure.
I see some of the officers start crying. One leans over and puts his arm around the other one. So right away, it set the tone for this was going to be a really emotionally taxing hearing. And it sure was.
Well,
it sure was.
Yeah. And Barbara, your response as well. And, you know, I'm sure like a lot of our listeners, I've watched a lot of hearings, you know, and they don't tend to have this deep. I mean, as I was listening to Kinzinger, I was welling up as he was welling up. What were your reactions?
Yes, the same. It was a very powerful day, very emotional. And I think part of it is that we all kind of lived that day together. It was televised. And the members of Congress were also, in many ways, the victims of that attack. And so I think it was extremely personal. And although we had all kind of heard and read about some of the details that the officers had experienced, to hear them tell it and to see that body camera footage, I think, really brought it home in a very personal way. You know, hearing a couple of the officers say, I really thought that this is how I'm going to die. And I think it also served a very important purpose of debunking some of the false information that has come out since January 6th, where members of Congress have tried to portray it as just an ordinary group of tourists, or President Trump has referred to the group as loving. And I think that we all saw and heard and felt yesterday just how false that is. So I think they laid down a really important marker for the historical record about what happened that day, so that it can't be erased by those who would prefer to remember it in a different way.
Well, picking up on that, and Luke, going back to you, there were two conservative Republicans, I should say, on the committee chosen by Nancy Pelosi. So it was interesting. We didn't have Jim Jordan. And would have been interesting, I think, to see what he actually would have done face to face with those officers. But nonetheless, you had a committee that was essentially on the same page.
Yes. And so that's been sort of the big fight over this committee, is who would sit on it and what direction it would take. And so Speaker Pelosi, who drafted the legislation to create this committee after the, and let me know if this is getting too in the weeds, but after the 9/11 style commission was blocked in the Senate, she created this select committee. And there was a dispute over who would get to be on it. Her belief was that only sort of serious fact finders should be on this committee, and that it should not turn into a partisan food fight. And so when Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader, nominated five Republicans to sit on it, she heard a lot of objections from her members to two of them. One, it was Jim Jordan, who had met with Donald Trump in December, and as they planned how to object to Joe Biden's victory on January 6th. And so there was a feeling that he might be a material witness in this case and therefore should not sit on the committee, and he should actually perhaps be called to testify. And the other was Jim Banks, who had recently organized a trip of House Republicans to the border to attend a Trump event. And then the day he was nominated, released a fiery statement undermining the committee and casting aspersions on its motivations. And so the Democrats felt that he was going to act as a saboteur on the committee and not actually participate in good faith. So Speaker Pelosi nixed both of them. In response, Kevin McCarthy pulled all five of his Republican nominees. And so Speaker Pelosi took the unprecedented step of appointing a second Republican of her choosing to the panel. So then there are now two Republicans, but they are Republicans who have pledged to get to the bottom of January 6th, not to have a partisan fight at the dais.
Well, let me play one more clip. And Barbara McQuaid, I'd like to get your response. And this is Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn. He's recounting how he confronted the rioters and that they called him the N-word. And I should say to our listeners that we did not bleep the N-word. It's about a minute and a half. Let's give it a listen.
I told them to just leave the Capitol. And in response, they yelled, "No, man, this is our house. President Trump invited us here. We're here to stop the steal. Joe Biden is not the president. Nobody voted for Joe Biden. I'm a law enforcement officer, and I do my best to keep politics out of my job. But in this circumstance, I responded, well, I voted for Joe Biden. Does my vote not count? Am I nobody? That prompted a torrent of racial epithets. One woman in a pink MAGA shirt yelled, "You hear that, guys? this nigger voted for Joe Biden. Then the crowd, perhaps around 20 people, joined in screaming, boo, fucking nigger. No one had ever, ever called me a nigger while wearing the uniform of a Capitol Police officer. In the days following the attempted insurrection, other black officers shared with me their own stories of racial abuse on January 6th. One officer told me he had never, and in his entire 40 years of life, been called a nigger to his face, and that streak ended on January 6th.
And Barbara, I want to get a response from you to that particular clip, and we wanted to play it in all its ugliness and all its emotion. But it's important to put these words out there so that we know what these officers were dealing with.
Yeah, I think the significance of what was said to Officer Dunn and his colleagues is significant on two levels. At its most basic level, they used this word as a weapon. They wanted to hurt him. The cruelty was the point. They wanted to disarm him and make him feel pain. And so that at its most basic surface level, I think that's why they chose to use that very ugly word. But I also think it signals that this is a group of white supremacist terrorists. And I think that point should not be overlooked. You know, I think sometimes people want to portray this group as protesters who got a little bit carried away. And maybe that's true of some of the people who were there that day. But there is at least a core group of people who were accurately described, I think, by Officer Hodges as terrorists. You know, in his statement, in his testimony, he used that term throughout. The terrorists did this, the terrorists did that. And when asked about that, he said, that is not a word I use lightly. And he pulled out the legal definition of domestic terrorism and read it to the group to explain why he had chosen to use that word. And, you know, of course, the word, in essence, is defined as violent acts dangerous to human life that are illegal and that are committed for the purpose of intimidating or coercing a civilian population, influencing government action, or interfering with government for the purpose by assassination, mass destruction, or kidnapping. It absolutely fits what happened that day. And so I think while we were looking at a very granular episode yesterday of what happened on January 6th, I think this committee needs to look a little more deeply into, number one, who was behind organizing this event. But even deeper than that, this rising, metastasizing cancer in our society of white supremacist domestic terrorism.
And that is Barbara McQuaid, who joined us along with Luke Broadwater. We're talking about yesterday's hearing before the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack. We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about yesterday's testimony before the House Select Committee that is charged with investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol and, frankly, on the U.S. Constitution. Again, Luke Broadwater, our guest, congressional correspondent for The New York Times, Barbara McQuaid, professor at the University of Michigan Law School. And we want to hear from you, especially if you watched or listened to the testimony. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. I noticed yesterday there were a lot of comments left on our Facebook page. Let me play another clip, and this is U.S. Capitol Police Sergeant Aquilino Gunnell, and he's recounting how his experience during the insurrection was more frightening than the time he served in Iraq during the war.
When I was 25 years old, and then a sergeant in the Army, I had deployed to Iraq for Operation Iraqi Freedom. From time to time, I volunteered to travel on IED-infested roads to conduct supply missions for U.S. and allied forces and local Iraqi population as well. But on January 6, for the first time, I was more afraid to work at the Capitol than my entire deployment to Iraq. In Iraq, we sped the armed violence because we were in a war zone. But nothing my experience in the Army or as a law enforcement officer prepared me for what we confronted on January 6th.
And Luke, he talked about being afraid of dying. He couldn't breathe. He's actually on medical leave, administrative leave. He had physical injuries. And yet he worked for the 15 days after the January 6th attack. He had some surgeries and apparently needs some more surgeries. Can you speak to just what he was telling us, Officer Gunnell?
Yes. I mean, Officer Gunnell, like so many Capitol Police officers, had a just terrifying experience on January 6th that stays with him today. I thought perhaps the most horrific part of his testimony was when he spoke about when he was on the front line protecting that tunnel from the mob as they were storming the building. And he was, along with others, crushed, and he felt sort of the oxygen leaving his lungs and that he might die in that moment. The Capitol Police Force has really been rocked by what happened January 6th, as has, frankly, almost everybody who was there that day. They've had dozens of officers resign. Many people are out on medical leave. Many have suffered PTSD. There are many people suffering very serious physical injuries as well. That's why I think this hearing was so powerful yesterday, because for the past 3 months or so, maybe I guess it's been 6 months.
That's right, 6 months.
The horrors of that day have sort of faded in the background of the public conscience, and it's turned into a lot of partisan back and forth, who's going to sit on committees, votes on bills, and the actual facts of what happened had faded. And so this was a reminder, a powerful reminder, as the committee was getting underway with its work, about what really happened, what were the wrongs that were done, why did we want to investigate? Because things like this should never happen, and somebody needs to get to the bottom of it. Well, and so that's why I think it cut through a lot of the partisanship.
Sure. And Barbara, let me go back to you. And I believe something like 500 people have been arrested by the Justice Department. And there's the evidence. I mean, if you watch videos of, and there are apparently just, hundreds and hundreds, maybe even thousands and thousands of hours of what happened on January 6th, there's your evidence. I mean, as a lawyer, does that hold up in court?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the video is very compelling evidence for the prosecution to use. It's the way that many of these people have been identified to be charged with crimes. But I think some of the details that were added yesterday by the officers are also very helpful. They would have to testify to these things again in court. You couldn't simply replay their recorded testimony. They'd have to say it again. But I think some of the details they added were really important yesterday. Again, as this time has passed and some in Congress have tried to whitewash this as, a loving crowd of ordinary tourists, and they talked about the weapons that this crowd had. They've been described as unarmed. Well, we didn't hear shots fired, but that doesn't mean there weren't people in the crowd with guns, they said. Good point. But the other is they talked about all of the weapons that were used against them, flagpoles, rocks. One described a sledgehammer. Officer Fanone said he was tased and electrocuted multiple times. Bottles, baseball bats, table legs, bear spray, broken pieces of metal from bike racks, and even a large metal speaker. We saw a video of that being thrown at one of the officers. And so the violence of that day was considerable. I think the other point that they made about the attack that's really important to rebut some of the disinformation is they said these were not members of Antifa. This was not Black Lives Matter protesters. This was not the FBI. These were Trump supporters. They said Trump sent them. They called us traitors. This is a group of white supremacists who support Donald Trump. And I think those points were clearly made for the record yesterday.
Luke, let me go back to you. And while this hearing was going on, a number of Republican members of the House, Paul Gosar, Louie Gohmert, Marjorie Taylor Greene, were having a press conference of some sort. Paul Gosar of Arizona said these are not unruly or dangerous or violent criminals. These are political prisoners who are now being persecuted. This is talking about the people who have been arrested. Louie Gohmert speculating, and I'm reading here from the Washington Post, we have political prisoners here in America. I mean, it couldn't be more stark and more inane to hear the words from these elected members of Congress.
Yes. Yeah, so the GOP was in the House GOP was in a full-fledged counter-programming mode yesterday. Before the hearing even began, the leadership of the House GOP came out and had a press conference at 8 a.m. In which they derided the committee as a sham and a partisan exercise. And then they, made a whole bunch of accusations that somehow Nancy Pelosi was to blame for the riot and not Donald Trump. And then as the hearing got underway and stretched on in a very serious manner for 3 hours, as it was ending, there was a press conference over by the Department of Justice that sort of the far right members of the House held. That turned into a complete circus. I don't know any other way to describe that. There was counter protesters, people blowing whistles, everyone yelling at each other. I mean, it was lies, misrepresentations, falsities, alternative realities. I mean, it was I don't know what to say about the state of some of these people in Congress. It's almost not even, you know, we don't. You know, I understand some people.
You cover them, right?
Yeah, but it's hard as a journalist because you can't just write down the lies people say and the crazy. So I don't know. I don't even know what to say. I guess I'm a little at a loss for words. But it was a circus, and I don't know how much attention or how much I even want to talk about that. So
no, yeah. I hear you. And let me just give Barbara a chance to weigh on that. I mean, in certain ways, it's a kind of political gaslighting, right? Where you say something that we've all observed, we've watched the videos, we saw what happened, and we've got people telling us, no, that didn't happen at all.
It really is. You know, I'm in the truth finding business as a former prosecutor, and so I find this sleight of hand game to be really disturbing. You know, certainly we all have our own opinions and our own takes on things, but to go out and misrepresent the facts, to try to blame Nancy Pelosi somehow for this, I saw a great remark on Twitter yesterday that said, if Nancy Pelosi were really to blame for this, do you really think that the Republicans would be fighting so hard to prevent these hearings from occurring and from boycotting them? No. Gosh, I mean, they're trying to distract and change the narrative. And boy, I just don't see how that rewards them in the end. I have to think that most Americans are also horrified by what they saw at the Capitol that day. You know, this isn't like the Benghazi hearings, which are kind of a, you know, made up, let's create a scandal where there is none. People saw with their own eyes. Five people died there. What a serious disaster and tragedy that was. And not only was there a loss of life, but it was in an effort to avoid the peaceful transfer of power in our democracy. I just have to think that most Americans were deeply disturbed by that. And I can't imagine arguing on the side of the terrorists in that situation. It's really strange to me, and I have to think and certainly hope that that strategy will backfire and ultimately change.
That's Barbara McQuaid, who joins us along with Luke Broadwater. I want to play one more clip, but first let me read a couple of comments. One from Carol of, I feel sick all over again at what happened that day and in the aftermath. Janet says, I really, really hope those responsible are held accountable. It's been a nightmare. Tommy says, the former president still doesn't condemn the most infamous attack on our young republic in our lifetime. Let me play another clip, and this is Metropolitan Police Officer Michael Fanone. He told the committee about how he was grabbed, beaten, tased, all while being called a traitor to my country. That's a quote. He was rushed unconscious to the hospital and suffered a heart attack, traumatic brain injury, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Let's give it a listen.
What makes the struggle harder and more painful is to know so many of my fellow citizens, including so many of the people I put my life at risk to defend, are downplaying or outright denying what happened. I feel like I went to hell and back to protect them and the people in this room. But too many are now telling me that hell doesn't exist, or that hell actually wasn't that bad. The indifference shown to my colleagues is disgraceful. My law enforcement career prepared me to cope with some of the aspects of this experience. Being an officer, you know your life is at risk whenever you walk out the door, even if you don't expect otherwise law-abiding citizens to take up arms against you. But nothing, truly nothing, has prepared me to address those elected members of our government who continue to deny the events of that day. And in doing so, betray their oath of office.
Barbara, let me get a response from you. And then Luke, I want to frame his comments here with a question to you. But that was powerful testimony from Officer Fanone.
Yeah, it was very compelling, I thought. And, you know, as one of the other officers said, you know, the party that claims to be the party of law and order is the party that is abandoning us and is telling us this isn't true and this didn't happen. I mean, they all kind of made this point that, you know, not only did I sacrifice my safety and came close to sacrificing my life to protect all of you people who work in this building, and yet half of you won't acknowledge the risk of that day. That is so deeply insulting and disgusting. And so I think that's what he was conveying. And I think he really made a strong point there. I wonder to what extent this will cause a turn in the way this event is viewed because of that appeal to those who care about law and order. I have to think that any people who are not strongly aligned with the extreme fringe of the Republican Party have got to find these men to be heroes and that argument to be very compelling.
Well, Luke, let me go back to you. And Minority Leader McCarthy, he said, and I'm sort of paraphrasing here, this was on January 6th. He said this is the saddest day of his time in Congress, the violence, the destruction, the chaos, that Donald Trump bears responsibility. That was 6 months ago. What is he saying now, if anything?
Yeah, it's been sort of a devolving situation on Capitol Hill on the Republican side of the aisle on how to respond to January 6th. Right after the attack, you know, I think there was widespread agreement in Congress that this was a horrible day for the country, that there were serious crimes committed, that President Trump played a huge role in making that happen, and people needed to be held accountable. Leader McCarthy at the time said, as you quoted, that he bears responsibility for January 6th. He pledged to endorse a fact-finding commission. But over time, as the emotions of that day, as the horrors of that day have somewhat faded and Donald Trump has reasserted himself as the leader of the Republican Party, even though he's out of office, and lawmakers have made pilgrimages down to him to get his blessing, the support for investigating January 6th has fallen away on the Republican side. McCarthy has gone from endorsing a commission to trying to block it. And now even taking the steps of threatening to strip from committees those Republicans who participate in the Select Committee. So we've seen a full-scale transformation from, you know, a widespread agreement that January 6th was wrong and people should be held accountable, to one party still believing that and the other either wanting to move on or switching to outright denials or engaging in wild conspiracy theories.
Barbara, going back to you, what do you hope then the committee, and we're almost up in a break here, but what do you hope that the committee then it does or finds, or maybe we should even ask sort of what you think it is charged to do? What is its goal?
Well, I compare it mostly to the 9/11 Commission. So first, to document what happened and chronicle that and gather all the facts, but also to point out the gaps so that recommendations can be made for improvements. It could be enough information that the Justice Department runs with it for criminal charges, but it could be just the way we treat violent extremism in this country, the way social media is used, and the way political parties and politicians are using disinformation to persuade voters to behave in certain ways. And so I think that would be a really important part of their mission.
And that is Barbara McQuaid, again, professor at the University of Michigan Law School. From 2010 to 2017, she served as U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. And she joins us along with Luke Broadwater. He's congressional correspondent for The New York Times. We're talking about and playing clips from yesterday's House Select Committee investigation into the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol. And again, you can join us by sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us the old-fashioned way. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Barbara McQuaid, let me ask you, you mentioned the Justice Department investigation. Help us understand what they are looking at. And I'm actually looking at a headline from the New York Times earlier this week. Trump officials can testify in inquiries into efforts to subvert election outcome and the January 6th riot, Justice Department says. Help us understand, I guess, what the Justice Department is looking at and the significance of this decision.
So in some ways, the Justice Department's investigation here is a little bit narrower than the investigation of the January 6th Select Committee, who has, you know, a bigger scope of kind of understanding what happened and maybe making recommendations for policy changes. The Justice Department is instead looking at criminal violations. So they are constrained by the U.S. Code, which lists out what all the crimes are. So far, we have seen what I would describe as more the low-hanging fruit, people who entered a restricted area, people who assaulted police officers, and they've even charged a few conspiracies, but minor ones, I would say, you know, against, say, groups of members of the Oath Keepers who actually had a concerted effort to be there that day. They planned ahead of time how they would be there, but they are charged only with a conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, the vote count. I think one thing that they might be looking for is something even bigger than that, which would be a seditious conspiracy. Hmm. That would be a larger organization to prevent the vote count from happening. It would be the charge really is pretty simple on its face. It is fighting against the authority of the United States, an agreement to do that. But I think as a matter of discretion and common sense, you're going to want a little more than what we have seen so far in terms of skirmishing with police officers. I shouldn't use that word. It minimizes it.
Fighting.
Brutally fighting with police officers. If they could find that there were people who funded and organized this effort, in an effort to thwart the certification of the election, I think that seditious conspiracy could be on the table. Now, the second question you asked about this decision by the Justice Department yesterday, I think is very significant because one could anticipate that members of the Trump administration would use executive privilege to as a shield to prevent testimony about what happened either in a grand jury in a criminal case or before the commission, the committee in this case. You know, people who were around President Trump that day, Mark Meadows, the chief of staff, senior advisors like Ivanka Trump and others who might have been at the White House who were with the president or even with him before January 6th, who were aware of planning that occurred. If they could use executive privilege, they could block the effort to subpoena them and get testimony. Now that the Department of Justice has said, because of these extraordinary circumstances, we don't believe that executive privilege ought to apply here. It ought to yield. Then I think they are without that protection. Now, they could still go to court on their own and try to get a different ruling. But I think that the Justice Department has made a very strong showing that will be very helpful to any entity that wants to get information from these people.
And a quick follow-up, and Representative Cheney said yesterday, we want the facts to lead us wherever they go, including to the White House. Do you think, Barbara McQuaid, that this opens the door to the former president Trump being subpoenaed to appear either before the Justice Department investigation or the House?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I think that the Justice Department is signaling that we are not going to defend you, President Trump, or anyone else in the White House under executive privilege. No, the Supreme Court ruled back in the big Nixon case in the 70s that executive privilege is a thing. You know, it's not articulated in the Constitution, but it is sort of inherent from this idea of the separation of powers, that the legislature has to kind of leave the executive branch to do its own thing. But the Supreme Court also said that executive privilege is not absolute, and under some circumstances, it must yield, as when there is a criminal investigation, as in the Nixon Watergate case. So I think here, in light of the opinion that the Justice Department issued yesterday, I think that we could see that heat up. Now, I think strategically, Congress might want to think about whether they call Donald Trump. It'll be a spectacle if he comes. He'll fight. He'll delay. He'll fight it in courts for years. But if there's something they genuinely need to know, and the only way to find it out is by asking him, then I think that's it's a risk worth taking. There's not really much of a downside. It sets a precedent. But if there's information that you need, then I think it's a battle worth fighting.
Luke, a couple of questions from our listeners here, some really basic questions. One from Bill. He says, why did the police officers never use their guns? And that was something that they mentioned, or certainly one or two of them mentioned yesterday. Can you respond to that?
Yes. So I've interviewed quite a few police officers at this point, and I've gotten to know some of these guys pretty well over the past 6 months. Almost everybody says some version of we were greatly outnumbered. If I had opened fire, it would have been even worse. So if I had shot somebody, they probably would have killed me or they would have fired back. There was a belief that people in the mob did have guns and were armed, and there were, you know, hundreds of cops defending the building that day, but there were thousands of protesters who became rioters or attackers. So, you know, obviously there was the one shooting by the House chamber that came at a very pivotal moment where the House lawmakers were fleeing the mob, and there was one door standing between the mob and them, and the window was smashed, and the first rioter jumped through or attempted to jump through and was shot. And that did push back the mob in that moment and allowed the lawmakers to escape. But most of the officers I've talked with say they think it would have been worse had they opened fire, that this it would have been a total bloodbath. There would have been many more people who died.
Barbara, let me go back to you. And actually looking, and you had a big piece in Just Security of the various questions that you would want to be asked during an investigation. But a number of those questions are about the intelligence failure, whether, you know, it was and the fact that it took hours to bring reinforcements to the Capitol. How serious is this?
Yeah, I think going forward, these would be some important topics for the committee to answer. You know, one category of witnesses I would want to talk to are those who are responsible for collecting and sharing intelligence, like the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security. We know that the Norfolk Field Office had information that people were coming to the Capitol to wage war, was the word that they used. And that bulletin never really got elevated or red flagged for the first responders, the Capitol Police and the D.C. Police. I think if they had been forewarned, they would have had more people there. They may have had rubber bullets. They may have had other types of resources available to them to fend off such a large attack. The idea that people got in the building is really deeply disturbing. You know, I know people who worked at the White House have said those people would have been shot. They would not have been allowed to breach the building. I mean, that's a terrible breach to let people in the building, but they were simply outmanned. So that's one. The other is, once it did become breached, why did it take so long for the National Guard to get there and to be called up? There's been a lot of conflicting statements at the Pentagon, who gave the signal. And I think you have to go into the inner circle of President Trump at the White House to find out what was going on there. He had the power to stop that, to stand up. You know, he ultimately made that video asking people to go home. What took him so long? Why did that happen? So I think all of those questions remain unanswered. And I think that the committee would be wise to pursue them in its coming hearings.
Luke, here's a question from Evelyn. The officers want the organizers held accountable, and only Congress can do that. Even if the committee does determine who is responsible, how likely is it that there will be any consequences? The officers have asked for more financial support and security, which hasn't been changed since 9/11. Given the balance of power in Congress, are even these two things possible? What do you say?
Well, I'll start with security. I do think that there will be a bipartisan agreement to fund large-scale security improvements. Already security has been improved, I would say. But there's a funding package right now that would do some significant upgrades to the campus, that would hire more police, and fund more training, more tactical gear. You know, one of the great tragedies of that day was that I think only about 170 officers had tactical gear to start the day on the Capitol Police Force. That's like 1 in 10. And so they were completely unprotected for the assault. So things like that I believe there will be funding for that. As for holding people accountable, that is the purpose of this committee. You know, after the impeachment of Donald Trump, the second impeachment, where they came up a few votes short in the it wasn't three, I think it was 11 actually, votes short in the Senate. To convict him, Leader McConnell said that Trump wasn't off the hook, that there would be consequences, and that there would be, they could be through the federal courts, through civil or criminal litigation. But this committee is another way to try to get at that. I do think there is some dichotomy that was brought up by the police yesterday, where you have, you know, 500 some low level, in many cases, rioters who have been arrested, but the orders they were following or thought they were following came from much higher people, and there hasn't been a true any real punishment for any of that. So that's a fair point your reader or your listener makes.
Sure. Well, and I think you and she are referring to Barbara McQuaid. I believe it was Dunn who said, you know, a hitman sent them. Mm-hmm. I don't have the whole quote there, but I think he was referring to the man who a couple hours earlier had said, I'm going to go down with you to the U.S. Capitol and stop this quote unquote steal.
Yeah, he made an analogy and said that, when you investigate a hitman, if you find that he committed the crime, you put him in jail. But you don't stop there. You also find the person who hired the hitman, who is considered the worst offender because they're the mastermind behind it all. Maybe they didn't get their hands dirty, but they're the one responsible for the crime. And what I think he is saying is, you're beginning by arresting all these people who are at the Capitol this day, but I would like you to get to the bottom of who sent the hitman. And so I think that is part of the mission of this group, is to hold accountable people at the highest levels.
Let me play one more clip. And again, this is from Captain Police Officer Harry Dunn, and was asked kind of what do you hope this committee can accomplish?
To the rioters, the insurrectionists, and the terrorists of that day, democracy went on that night and still continues to exist today. Democracy is bigger than any one person and any one party. You all tried to disrupt democracy that day, and you all failed.
Do you agree with that, Barbara McQuaid?
Yes, absolutely. And, I credit Mike Pence and others who were quite insistent that they come back that day. It was a delay in the vote by several hours, which in itself is really disturbing. But it was very important that the members of Congress come back that night and cast that vote for that certification. So I do agree that the terrorists lost that day.
Luke, Tom says, is the purpose of this investigation to bring more charges? Also, a caller wants to know if there's a date for the next hearing. Do you have an answer to those questions, Luke?
There's no date for the next hearing, but we do know that the committee chair has said they expect these hearings to go into next year and the investigation to go into next year.
Wow.
So this is not going to be a short, quick hit thing. But we'll find out what their next step will be shortly, I believe. What was the first part of the question?
Is the purpose of this investigation to bring more charges?
I guess we'll see about that. I mean, one thing that, Liz Cheney said yesterday is they're not going to leave any stone unturned. She wants to see every email, every call log, every event, every meeting that happened leading up to January 6th. And they're really going to be taking a hard look at every single document in the possession of the White House that still exists from that day. And then they're going to be demanding documents and testimony from Trump and his inner circle, as you discussed earlier.
Right.
So there is potential that, depending on what they uncover, we could see more consequences. They plan to be like a dog with a bone on this and not give it up and keep pursuing till they really unearth some facts that people haven't seen before.
Barbara, almost out of time, but what? Buckle up. There's going to be more to come.
Yeah, I think that's right. And one of the things I think they have learned their lesson from prior efforts to hold the Trump administration accountable about delay in serving subpoenas. I know Liz Cheney and others yesterday said, not only do we want to serve subpoenas, we want to serve them right away. Because if there's going to be any battle back and forth over who's giving over what, let's get going on that. Let's go. Let's not delay. And I think that in an effort to do things the old way of voluntary compliance and just asking people to turn things over, we've seen just doesn't work. So send out those subpoenas. If you can work out some accommodation, that's great. But I don't think we can expect that kind of courtesy from members of the Trump administration.
Well, we got to leave it there. Barbara McQuaid, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And she's a professor at the University of Michigan Law School. Luke Broadwater, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And he is congressional correspondent for The New York Times. We appreciate all those questions and comments that you had as well. Go to whyy.org and look for Radio Times under programs. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us.